Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we're covering today, Friday, August 24th, 2018. The head of the UN Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan says rapes and killings continue in the country.
A number of the young adults were raped and sexually violated, and several others detained and tortured.
And a new report warns of hundreds of thousands of children who may be at risk of death in South Sudan.
1.1 million children at risk of malnutrition this year alone, as a nation, not specific to counties. And out of this is 300,000 at risk of death.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The UN Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan says it is very concerned about the delay in the establishment of a hybrid court in South Sudan to try people suspected of carrying out human rights abuses, including rape and killings, during the five-year-long conflict. After a week-long tour of South Sudan, the head of the United Nations Commission told reporters today that human rights violations continue unabated in South Sudan. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA. From Juba.
During their 5 days in South Sudan, the team of three UN Human Rights Commissioners visited Wau, Ye, and Juba, where they recorded conversations with internally displaced persons and alleged victims of human rights abuses as part of their effort to collect evidence of violations. That evidence could be brought before a hybrid court when such a court is finally established. It was supposed to be set up under the 2015 peace deal, which fell apart in 2016. It has yet to be created. Yasmin Soka, chair of the Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan, says government and rebel forces continue to commit serious human rights violations. Soka told reporters in Juba today about the team's recent visit to a school in Ye River State's Goli village, where they spoke with survivors of an attack by SPLA soldiers.
The attack on the school resulted in five school children, three staff members and two IDPs being killed by government soldiers in May of this year. Our team was also informed that a number of the young adults were raped and sexually violated, and several others detained and tortured. The survivors of the attack who remained have demonstrated extraordinary courage, with one of them saying, and I quote, "If I leave my community, there will be no person standing for them or speaking up for them. My community is relying on me."
Soka says women and religious groups told her team they are concerned that if perpetrators are not held accountable and justice is not delivered to victims, reconciliation and healing will never happen.
Both groups were cautiously optimistic about the peace process. At the same time, they constantly raised the issue of impunity and the complete absence of state action on accountability for the daily violations experienced at the hands of various armed groups, including those belonging to the government.
Soka says President Salva Kiir's recent amnesty might delay efforts to establish an independent hybrid court per the 2015 peace deal.
We also noted our concern at the lack of progress on the establishment of the hybrid court. We also raised with the government the issue of the amnesty that has been announced from Khartoum, arising out of the recent peace negotiations. And we were also informed that the government intends to set up a special court for conflict-related sexual violence. And of course, as this moves along, what we will be looking at is what potential impact that may have on Chapter 5 of the peace agreement.
The Commission is also concerned about the difficulties the IDPs have in returning to their homes when they are occupied by others. Soka says she is also concerned about the proliferation of arms among different groups fighting alongside the rebels and government forces. UN Human Rights Commissioner Bani Afako, who was part of the team, says establishing a hybrid court requires the political will of the South Sudan government and the African Union.
The institutions and the mechanisms of transitional justice are not up for renegotiation during the revitalization. The focus, the main focus, as you know, has been on questions of security arrangements as well as power sharing. So it's our full expectation that when the revitalization is completed, at the end of that process, there would be a document that will leave these institutions intact.
Soka says the commission will also visit neighboring Uganda, Sudan, and Kenya, where the team will visit refugee camps and settlements along the South Sudan border before holding meetings with the African Union, IGAD, and top UN officials in Addis Ababa at the end of next week. The commission plans to present an oral update on South Sudan's human rights status to the UN Human Rights Council on September 17th and a comprehensive written report in March next year. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
The humanitarian agency CARE International says more than 300,000 children are severely malnourished in the country of South Sudan. This week, CARE released its findings of a nutrition survey that was conducted in the former Unity State. It indicates that many of those children could, in fact, die. Owen Walter Solomon has more for VOA from Juba.
CARE International says the number of children suffering from severe and moderate acute malnutrition in the counties of Mayom, Pariang, and Robkona shows an extreme increase compared to the same period last year. Dimelas Hapti is CARE International Nutrition Specialist in South Sudan.
When you look at it nationally, as per the humanitarian response plan, and 1.1 million children at risk of malnutrition this year alone, as a nation, not specific to counties, and out of this is 300,000 at risk of death related to these nutrition situations.
Hapti says the three counties registered remarkably high global acute malnutrition rates, which far exceed the World Health Organization's 15% emergency threshold.
High rate of malnutrition is associated with food insecurity in these locations, in addition to health illness, which also contribute for malnutrition. Mayom is 18.3%, the global acute malnutrition. Pariang is 19.6%, and Robkona is 17.8%.
Hapti says the CARE teams are working to treat malnourished children as well as educating mothers on how to feed their children to prevent malnutrition in the three affected counties. He says his agency supports nutrition services in health facilities at primary health care centers and primary care units at the Boma levels, along with providing mobile outreach services in hard-to-reach areas.
We have using the mother-to-mother support groups and key volunteers to provide maternal infant child feeding counseling so that the prevention aspect will be also addressed in addition to the treatment. Treatment is not enough. We need to focus also nutrition-sensitive programs, which can be, you know, addressed in food security livelihood project, in WASH, in education, so that nutrition to be, you know, multi-sectoral response.
Hapti says CARE International is working with 45 civil society organizations in South Sudan under a group referred to as the Scaling Up Nutrition Movement to increase focus on nutrition-sensitive interventions to reduce malnutrition. He says CARE is appealing for $14 million to treat severely malnourished children and to prevent the spread of malnutrition in the area of the former Unity State. For VOA News, I am Onen Walter Solomon in Juba.
Youth leaders in Ye River State are complaining about the government's decision to suspend operations of the Ye River State Youth Union. The state minister for youth and sports issued a decree last week shutting down the office of the union after accusing its leaders of failing to comply with government regulations. Daniel Friday Martin has more on the story for VOA from Ye.
Information, Youth and Sports Minister Alfred Kennedy-Dugu says he sat down the youth union because the group is operating illegally in the state.
The suspension of the youth union, it is a normal procedure because, according to my knowledge and my information, the period that the youth union was mandated for was 6 months from last year. and this time, this period has elapsed. Number two, holding any public office, it is an assignment. But I would like to say that there will be establishment of an interim body to carry out the interests of the youth and to represent the youth.
But youth activists say the leadership of their union is not any concern of the minister, and Doko's decision violates the country's constitution. James Yata is the Secretary General of the Ye River State Youth Union.
Our Constitution of the Republic of South Sudan provides each and every citizen of this great nation the freedom to socialize and come together. But the government of Ye River State has taken it in a very negative way. Now with this suspension, it is going to drop us from 10 steps up to down. That means with the youth of Ye River State, we will also begin from zero. I am not happy at all, and I will not really keep quiet. I will really speak so that things are put in order.
Yata says suspending youth programs will negatively impact the participation of youth in efforts to develop the state. Malese Stephen Cosmas, president of the Ye River State Union, thinks the government imposed the shutdown because young people openly complained during a recent event to commemorate International Youth Day.
This is a total violation of our freedom of expression within Ye River State, because we have the right to express our opinion or our challenges, and we have the right to explain to the leadership of the state, to the youths, be calm. So we need to continue to talk to the leadership of the state so that this ministerial order is looked upon.
Ye Town President Noel Akichak says shutting down the youth union will break down the relationship between the government and youth across the state.
I am a youth and I have a problem. Should I actually go straight to the governor to consult? It will not make any sense. So I'm just urging that what the government should open the youth's office back, because there are a lot of issues that really we need to share among ourselves.
The union's leaders are calling on the state officials to revoke the decision and say they will sue Minister Doko in a court of law should the government fail to resolve the issue amicably. They also charge the shutdown is intended to block their participation in implementing a revitalized 2015 peace agreement. The Ye River State Youth Union was formed in May 2017 with the aim of uniting all youth in Ye River State's 13 counties. The union says its main activities are peace campaigns, poverty reduction through agriculture, and advocacy. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Ye.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A doctor may be infected with a strain of the deadly Ebola virus in the DRC. More on that when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is the greatest lesson you have learned from a relationship or marriage?
The greatest lesson I've learned is to accept others based on who they are and not based on what you want them to be.
Human beings are not perfect. They can hurt you sometimes, but then you also need to forgive.
I've learned not to give too much and not to trust at all. Because I gave too much, I gave myself fully, and I never reaped anything out of it.
It's that of trust. It's that of trust, because without trust, there is no way you can thrive on with a relationship.
In marriage, I have learned one thing: to be patient.
I cannot trust a woman 100%, you know. That is relationship. And I think I cannot cheat on my woman, because she is my woman. So that is my experience.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. The United Nations reports that Ebola has spread to a town in North Kivu in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The patient is a doctor living in Oicha town, an area surrounded by an Islamic militia group, the Allied Democratic Forces. Initial tests for the doctor were negative, but his wife, who traveled to the nearby town of Beni, is infected, and he is being tested again after falling ill. Nearly 100 of his contacts have been identified. World Health Organization officials say insecurity is making it difficult to access affected areas. The militia surrounding Oicha Town are holding aid workers, government officials, and priests. Earlier in the week, UN peacekeepers escorted health workers to Oicha. So far, the epidemic has infected at least 103 people. There have been 63 documented deaths in North Kivu and Ituri provinces. The outbreak, which began on August 1st, is the 10th to hit the Congo since 1976. Zimbabwe's top court has confirmed the results of last month's presidential election, clearing the way for Emmerson Mnangagwa to be inaugurated president. The ruling rejects the opposition MDC Alliance's challenge to the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission's decision that Mnangagwa won with 50.8% of the vote. Patrick Chinamasa is the ZANU PF Secretary of Finance.
We are very happy that the Constitutional Court has upheld the free will of the Zimbabwean people, which was expressed on 30th of July 2018 when they voted. And this is despite the attacks, after attacks, the barrage of attacks that were launched against ZEC itself and the chairperson of ZEC and the electoral system. There was also a barrage of attacks launched against the Constitutional Court itself and seeking to undermine the judiciary. Now, notwithstanding these attacks, our institutions have weathered these attacks, have stood the test of time, and have been able to overcome the challenges. And what comes out is that we have world-class institutions, we have world-class standards.
The Constitutional Court judges ruled that the MDC failed to prove convincingly that there was widespread voter fraud. 23 candidates ran, but the top contenders were the ruling ZANU-PF party's Mnangagwa and the MDC Alliance's Nelson Chamisa. Douglas Manzora is the Secretary General for the MDCT, one of the opposition parties. He says his party does not agree with the ruling and the election should have been annulled.
We still believe that the election was not free and fair. We still believe that the election was manipulated. There are a number of things that we can do, but I do not want to preempt the National Executive Council of the MDC, which is meeting next Wednesday, to decide the way forward. But there are a number of options.
And Peter Pham is the vice president of the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C., and he says all sides need to move calmly.
But are the people appointed figures who can reconcile, who can bridge gaps, or are they going to be hardliners who exacerbate the divisions within society? Probably it's incumbent on everyone to act responsibly. The government needs to restrain security forces from overreacting. It's their responsibility to do so. The opposition also needs to be responsible. Getting people incited to provoke a reaction is not the way to vindicate their objection.
Mnangagwa has served as president since November, when the army ousted Robert Mugabe, who had led the country for 37 years. The move came after Mugabe fired Mnangagwa as vice president and took actions that would have placed his wife in a position to succeed him as president. While the vote was considered to be one of the most peaceful and relatively free in Zimbabwe's history, at least six people died when security forces cracked down on protesters a few days after the July 30th vote. There are fears that angry opposition supporters may, in the coming days, again take to the streets. That report was prepared by Kudzai Svinavashi. Uganda's former head of police, Kale Kalihura, appeared in military court today. He was charged with arming a criminal gang and for allowing refugees to be abducted by the police. Among those allegedly kidnapped was Joel Mutabazi, a former bodyguard of Rwandan President Paul Kagame. Mutabazi was taken from a UN refugee camp in 2013 and returned to Rwanda. Kaihura was appointed police chief 13 years ago. President Yoweri Museveni fired him in March. Kaihura fought alongside Museveni and helped bring him to power. His case has been adjourned until September 4th. The hearing comes a day after five members of parliament, including Robert Kyagulani, a pop singer known as Bobby Wine, appeared in court on treason charges. They were arrested last week after a protest blocked Museveni's motorcade during campaign events for a by-election. We turn now to relations between Ethiopia and Eritrea. The two countries normalized relations last month after 20 years in a state of war. But both are believed to still have thousands of troops stationed along their shared border. Analysts say the way leaders handle this sensitive topic will be a barometer for future relations. Mohamed Yusuf has this report for VOA from Nairobi.
Ethiopia and Eritrea have taken major steps toward peace in the past month, resuming flights, reopening telephone links, and allowing families to meet after more than 20 years of separation. But the Horn of Africa neighbors still have issues on the security front, especially in regards to the troop station along their 1,000-kilometer-long shared border. In July, Eritrean media say troops have withdrawn from the border, but that has yet to be independently confirmed. Political expert Awol Alo says the issue can be resolved if the two governments can muster enough political will.
Well, as two countries that were on a war footing for the last, as I said, 20 years, it is one of the most complex security problems you can imagine. But at the same time, it is really a security problem that can easily be resolved in the sense that once the underlying political disagreements and political problems are addressed, the security problems are not that complicated.
Between 1998 and 2000, Ethiopia and Eritrea fought a war over disputed territory on the border that claimed an estimated 70,000 lives. Since the war, the East African neighbors have accused each other of supporting rebel movements and opposition groups in each other's territory. But in June, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said his government was ready to respect a 2002 Boundaries Commission ruling that gave the disputed town of Badame to Eritrea. Meresa Desu, a senior researcher with Institute of Security Studies, says the countries are still wary of each other.
We
cannot say by now the army are in demilitarized area. The military is still there. It is a cautious relation among them. Alo says the strength of newfound peace will be judged by how the countries can manage their border issues.
Security, as I said, is the primary. Demilitarizing the border is one of the key, for example, measure by which people can judge that the two countries are moving forward. So Eritrea withdrawing its forces, Ethiopia withdrawing its forces from the border area, and the border becoming kind of a normal border that doesn't necessarily feature such a huge movement of armed forces.
Before the border war, Eritrea fought a long war for independence from Ethiopia, which it achieved in 1993. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The South African government today apologized to white farmers for what it calls poor communication about its possible expropriation of their land in order to speed up agricultural reform and to put more farmland in the hands of black citizens. The apology comes at the start of a nationwide public consultation process on land reform. 24 years after the end of apartheid, the vast bulk of the country's commercial farmland is owned by whites, who make up only about 8% of the total population. Director General of Agriculture Mike Melengana today said the proposed constitutional amendment to allow for land expropriation without payment has been misinterpreted as the beginning of a state assault on white farmers. Darren Taylor reports.
A gathering of white and black farmers in Limpopo province has highlighted the many land reform projects that are being driven by white farmers. Some have already given their land to black people and are mentoring them to become fully-fledged commercial food producers. Mlengana says it's a pity that the African National Congress government has up until now been ignorant of most of these white-driven initiatives. He revealed that Minister of Agriculture Senzeni Zokwana has chastised state officials for not allaying white farmers' fears that their land is about to be taken.
And the minister stands up. You government officials are talking to us DGs. Why have you not gone out and speak to the farmers? There is no thing like that. Where does it come from that we are coming with gun blazings to take white commercial land?
Mlengana also says a list circulating identifying 139 white-owned farms to be taken by the government has been misinterpreted. He says the 139 white landowners are simply asking the government to pay too much for their land, so the state will ask a court to determine a fair price for the farms. Mlengana emphasized that white farmers have a future in South Africa.
Those who are going overseas and doing all that, they are destroying the future of this country. You are killing this country. The day your friends up there kill this country, they are killing the economy of this country. Where are you going to live? Even if you go overseas and say, I'm running to Australia, I'm running, they will distrust you. Because wherever there is a debate, your first interest, not the national interest, matter more.
The Director General says the future of agriculture in South Africa is white and black farmers working together, funded by government.
At this point, you have been using your money. At this point, you have been trying to get there. There is money available that I'm trying to channel towards that partnership.
In the midst of allegations of widespread corruption within the land reform process, Mlengana said the Department of Agriculture is committed to better administration and has to manage taxpayer funds much better. White farmers at the gathering have cried as they've pledged to correct the wrongs of the country's apartheid past. As one put it, our fathers stole the land, and if we are given the chance, we will hand it back, but only to skilled black farmers who are dedicated to producing food for the country. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Bela Bela, South Africa.
That is our show for this Friday. We leave you with the song Work by Adekunle Gold.
No food for lazy man. Body double your work, anything where you want to, you go get them if you want. My work while I go shisha, stop living fake life. Ororo no be too doy, pussy cat no be tiger, monkey at the fishing party. Work you, work you, but I no be for monkey. You wanna have a big boy, so I got unje vole. Work you. You say you want expensive shit, but from a far away we see. You where you never am out, but from a bad one walk brother. You go rock and my run down. Body me double your solo. Respect yourself, yo. Stop living fake life. Ororo no be too doy. Pussy cat no be tiger. Monkey at the fishing party. Walk yo, walk yo. But I no be for monkey yo. You wanna have a big boy. Swagger on je vole yo. Walk yo, walk yo. For me te pa manche yo. Walk yo.
We've been listening to Adekunle Gold with the song Work No more work for this week. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for being here. We'd like your feedback on our show. You can find us at southsudan@voanews.com or contact us on Facebook. Our title is South Sudan in Focus. Have a fantastic weekend and join us again on Monday for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.